Do you think that the Cold War, I asked you earlier about the bankers in Russia and who controlled the money system in Russia. What I was leading to was, if our money was backing the earliest Russians, and if our bankers were friendly with the earliest Russians, and if they were indeed financing them to some degree, was the Cold War a put-up job? Was there really ever a difference? Because if our bankers were running Russia's banks, and if they were running our banks, they would know better than to know, you know, that Russia would be against us to the degree that we were all told during the Cold War they were against us. Do you think that there was some kind of put-up job on an enormous scale here?
I don't know whether, and I don't mean to be talking down to anybody, most of all present company. The Cold War started before the end of World War II. Our OSS people made contact with what they considered to be valuable intelligence agents within the Russian sphere before the war ended, when the Russians were still our allies. And they exfiltrated those people, about 50-50, Nazis and pro-Nazis. And Mr. Dulles' deputy, Frank Wisner, was stationed in Bucharest. Dulles was in Switzerland, was in Bucharest, Romania. And we had a lot of POWs, American air crews in Romania, that we'd been bombing the Ploiesti oil field. A lot of planes were shot down because all low-level bombing. And so it was a humanitarian effort for Wisner to try to find ways to get these POWs out. In the brief interval, by the time the Russian army was coming into Romania across that border, and the German army was fleeing out of Romania in the northwest border. So in that some two-week period, he put together a freight train, a big freight train, and he put 750 Americans on that freight train, POWs. And these Nazis that he was taking out, he stuck them in the freight train. So he got them out of there. Well, now, the object of the whole thing was viewing, from their point of view, the OSS point of view, and they had British help in this, that the enemy in the future, the post-war future, was going to be communism. And so they bring these guys out, and the freight train went through the Balkans with the doors sealed, like any freight train, came out in Turkey, and as it entered Turkey, General Giles, who was a commanding general in Cairo, head of the Middle East Command, called my boss at Cairo, and I happened to be chief pilot there. He said, have planes enough to go up there and pick these men up and bring them out when they get off the train. Because after the train goes through Turkey on this regular track that's there, it goes, because there were mountains, it goes into Syria for several miles. And it's only just barely across the border, but it's in Syria. So my boss, a general named Smith, and I went up there the day before and reconnoitered the ground, because no airfield, and we found a place we could operate from, and we talked to the British who were stationed there, and they said it was a pretty good deal. So we went up to, I went up, took 40 airplanes the next day, and went up there, and we just landed and waited, and sure enough, here came the freight train, and it stopped. And the doors opened, and out came these guys just running across that place, and said, we'll fill one airplane and send them out, and the next plane, and the next plane. And I had the general's plane, which had plush seats and all, and the last guys to come out, some of them had been injured, and we had nurses with us and all, got on my plane to go out, and I noticed that some other guys just standing in the aisle that looked just kind of extra, because I wasn't on the other plane. I didn't realize there were so many of them. And they weren't Americans, and they were these Romanians and whatever from the Balkans, plus Nazis that they had gotten to change over, you see, like Galen did. The head of German intelligence, General Galen, changed, and he was picked up the same way, but he went out through Germany. And I brought these fellows down to Cairo. Well, the minute they got to Cairo, there were cars there to whisk them off, and we never saw them again. But that's evidence of the beginning of the Cold War, because that was in September of 44, and a German surrender came in May of 45.
Well, I guess what I was getting at was the Cold War truly a real thing? Because, in other words, if our bankers are running the banks in Russia, was the Cold War an honest concert, or was it something where it was just done to sort of suck money out of the American people and the Russian people and put a bogeyman, you know, that we were the bogeyman for the Russians, am I right? And they were the bogeyman for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there was any
chance. If you read Buckminster Fuller's enormously important book called Critical Path, computer term, Critical Path, he states very clearly that the so-called Cold War created expenditures, and he died in 83, so he's talking about 45 to 83, of over $6 trillion. Now, if $6 trillion had not changed hands and then multiplied as it changed between 45 and 83, there would have been, our business world would have been a lot different than it was, including the Soviets' business world and the British and everybody else. Or as the book I quote so often, the Leonard Lewin's book, The Report from Iron Mountain, our governments do not know how to operate without the threat of war. And he says that Kennedy started a commission of people to study what we had to do to run a nation in a time of permanent peace, when you could just say you don't need a defense department. He said, you know, well, how are you going to do it? And he said that in his studies of Washington and everything, we can't. We don't know how to do it. So the Cold War sufficed for war. And, of course, the frosting on the cake was a real thing, the atom bomb. You see, war had always taken time to get itself going, like World War II. It began in the fall of 39. We didn't get in until, the beginning of 42. And in that period, we armed ourselves and everybody else and got things going. By the time we got into the war, you know, the war had been going a pretty good war because everything was slow, went by ship, and so on. Well, with the nuclear weapons, and I know I went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff College, the Armed Forces Staff College in 55, and I remember the admirals and generals talking to us at that period. They couldn't contemplate the use of nuclear weapons. And I'm not talking about humane action. I mean, what good would it do? What good does it do to blow every damn city in the world up and then have radioactive floating all over the place? There's nothing left. Earth would be dead. And this really pervaded the military mind much more than it did the civilian mind. And I've been sent to nuclear schools, and I've listened to the instructors talk about it. And I worked in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I worked for three different secretaries of defense, McElroy, Gates, and McNamara. I've attended probably more people, more meetings of that type than the average. And really, it was the shadow of the nuclear weapons up there that caused these people to be confronted with the feeling of an enormous potential war, and yet the day after it starts, it's over, see? And you can't really plan war. So the Cold War atmosphere prevailed, but nobody would know how to fight it, really. So we had Korea and we had Vietnam, and they had no objectives. Clark Clifford, Secretary of Defense after McNamara, wrote a book. In the beginning of the book, he said, I talked with Johnson about why are we in Vietnam? What's our objective in Vietnam? And he said, Johnson never gave me an answer. Well, as a Secretary of Defense, I mean, you can't have a war without an objective. That's the, as Clausewitz says, the principal motive of a war is the objective for fighting it. You know, not just victory, not just intangible term. You have to have an objective. Well, what was our objective in Vietnam? We were there for 30 years and we never had one.
Except to spend our money, I guess.
Well, see, you're back to where you started, aren't you, with the money. Okay, that's what they're all talking about, $6 trillion. And Buckminster Fuller, that's why I say his book is so very important, because he understood things that way and he predicated his whole book on that kind of thinking, which is accurate thinking. They were making money. They were causing money to move.